Amen. Well, I want to start by introducing you to my dog. I think we've got a picture. There you go. She's pretty cute, isn't she? Yeah, a very masculine dog for me. Sort of dog you could put in your ute and drive around, and everyone thinks, "Now that's a tough guy." We got a sign that sits on the gate above it that says, "Beware of the dog." And little Kipsy, this tiny little thing, sits under it. There you go. Even Kipsy, the name speaks of strength, doesn't it, and power. I wanted to call her Ninja, but Ninja got second best, so she's now Kipsy Ninja, which people... Tipsy? Is that a Tipsy Ninja? I got this great image in my mind. Kipsy's our dog. We own her. I have power over her. Yeah, she's smaller than me. She's mentally less able than me, I think. She's vulnerable. She can't get food for herself. She lives in our house, determined by our rules. I determine how her life is in many ways. I have power over her. Now, I could use that power in her life for great good or great harm. You see, power in itself isn't an evil thing, but the expression of the power, how you exercise that power, can be exercised for great good or great ill. I could use it for great ill in her life. I could mistreat her. I could fail to feed her. I could abuse her. We could neglect her. We could make her life absolutely miserable. I could exercise my power in such a way that it has devastating consequences for her life. Or I could treat her with great care. I could look after her, show her affection, feed her, give her rules, but rules that aren't onerous, give her a happy life where she feels loved, where she loves us, where we enjoy company together. I could use my power for great good in her life, and we try to do that. Now, we might get rid of Kipsy. Go away, Kipsy. This is what it's like at home, too. Good one. Power can be exercised for great good or great evil. When I was at high school, I had a history teacher called Mr. J. And Mr. J, basically every lesson, in fact, usually multiple times a lesson, would say, "Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts, absolutely." And so he said it so many times, you could never forget it. In fact, I think he got it slightly wrong. I think it's power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts, absolutely. A famous quote by Lord Acton. But a helpful, healthy quote, not in the sense that it's absolutely true, even though it has absolutely in the sentence, but in the sense that it's a truism. It's generally true. When people have power, it tends towards corruption. And the more power they have, the more it tends towards corruption. And if they have absolute power, it's very hard to resist the impulse towards corruption. And we've all experienced it, the misuse of power. You will have had a boss, or you have a boss. You will have had teachers who have exercised their power in such ways that it's been an abuse of their power. It's been for ill rather than for good. They could have used their power in such a way that it nurtures, that it serves, that it builds up, that it develops their students, that it develops their workers, has a great impact for good. But instead, haven't we all experienced those over us, and it might be in a sporting organisation or anywhere where there's power, where the person exercises their power in such a way that they're a petty tyrant. They have no control anywhere else in their life, but here they're the ruler, and so they're going to rule with an iron fist. Haven't you experienced the sadistic ruler, the one who is over you and enjoys making your life a misery, enjoys doing things that upset you, that cause you discomfort? That have you not had the corrupt official whose friends and favourites always seem to get ahead and get the good marks and get the good positions, but you keep being stopped and blocked at every possible promotion? Have you not met the leader who lets you do all the work, and they take all the credit? And multiple more expressions of those in leadership over us, in work situations, in schooling situations, in any situation where there's power. Now, that's small scale. But what happens when it's on a massive scale, when the power is multiplied and magnified? What happens when it's in massive corporations, huge business enterprises, governments, dictatorships? And we've just seen that roll throughout the pages of history. Despotism, corruption, suppression of the truth, silencing of any voice that speaks out in opposition, control through military might, warfare, atrocities, even genocide in order to remove any opposition to power. Power can be exercised for great good or for great evil. And we come here to this passage, and it's a passage in the corridors of power. It's filled with power players. It's the highest echelons of society of Jesus' day. And so it begs the two questions: where does power lie here? Where does true power lie? And how is it exercised here? So firstly, in the account, where does power lie? Who is the one with the power in this account? Well, straight away, I think it's obvious that the power doesn't lie with Peter. You see, we meet Peter in the very first couple of verses, 53, 54 of chapter 14, and he's slinking around in the background. Jesus is being brought before the power players, high priest, chief priests, elders of the people, teachers of the law, up into the highest ranks of Jewish leadership. He's going to stand trial. Peter follows, but he follows at a distance. He stays outside in the courtyard, the high priest's courtyard, and sits by the fire, warming himself with the guards. Now, Peter is trying to be faithful to Jesus. He said he wants to follow Jesus whatever the cost, and he's trying to do that. He probably feels ashamed that when Jesus was arrested, he ran away with all the other disciples. And so he's making an effort to follow Jesus, but he's following at a distance. He's sort of slinking around in the background, trying not to be noticed. In verse 55, you see that the scene shifts. So you're outside with Peter, and then the scene shifts and you're inside in the Sanhedrin, the Jewish court. And then it shifts and you're outside again with Peter. And then it shifts and then you're inside again with Pilate in the Roman court political situation. The scene shifts in and out. And so you see in verse 66, it shifts back outside and goes back to Peter. And we find Peter there still warming himself by the fire. A servant girl comes up and challenges Peter. You are with Jesus. Now, it's just a little servant girl, but straight away he denies it. And he moves. He goes into the entryway, which you've experienced that. Someone does something uncomfortable, I've got to get away. And so he tries to go somewhere a little bit safer. The same girl sees Peter there and says to one of the people standing around, "This fellow is with him." Now, Peter straight away denies it, because you've had that experience too, haven't you? Where someone points out publicly something uncomfortable about you. So he denies it straight away. After a while, someone else says to Peter, "You must be one of his disciples. You're a Galilean." Something in his speech or his dress has given him away. Now, this time, Peter calls down curses upon himself and swears, "I don't know this man that you're talking about." Denial 3. And verse 72, chapter 14. "Immediately the rooster crowed the second time. Then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken to him, 'Before the rooster crows twice, you'll disown me three times.' And he broke down and wept." Jesus' words come to fulfillment. His predictions and prophecies always do. Peter disowns Jesus three times and he weeps bitterly. In one of the other Gospels, it said Jesus looked up and saw him, and Peter weeps bitterly. Now, just as a bit of an aside, what do you do when you're Peter there? How do you come back from that? Such a devastating denial and betrayal of someone you love. You feel so deeply wrecked and devastated. And haven't we all been there? Haven't you all felt that denial of Jesus, the time you should have spoken up, the time you should have said those words, the sin that you've fallen into again and again you shouldn't, and yet the terrible thing you've done, where you have felt like Peter and felt that you have broken relationship with Jesus so severely, have betrayed him and denied him so severely, that deep inside you weep, or even outside you weep for how you've treated the Lord. But have a bit of a look at this. I think this is really cool. Flip with me to the end of Mark's Gospel, Mark 16, verse 7. Just a cool little act of love and kindness. Mark 16, so Jesus died, he's risen, the women come to the tomb early. There's no one there. The stone's been rolled away. Jesus isn't there. Angel appears and said, "Jesus is risen." But look at verse 7. "But go tell his disciples and Peter, he's going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." Go tell his disciples and Peter. He's going to go ahead of you in Galilee. He's going to see you there. Now, why is that there? Why and Peter? I wonder if it's because Peter's the one who really needs to hear this. Now, all the disciples do. They'd all fled. They'd all left Jesus alone in his greatest time of need. And so they all need to hear, Jesus is risen. He's back. He's not dead. Remember his promise. He's going to meet you in Galilee. There's going to be restored relationship. You haven't blown it. There is forgiveness with Jesus. But I think he particularly says, and Peter. Make sure Peter hears this. Because remember, Peter said, Even if everyone else falls away, even if everyone else, I won't. Even if I have to die with you, Jesus, I will not deny you. And yet denial, denial, denial. And so I think deep within Peter, he is the one who really, really needs it. I think Jesus is saying, I'm going to see you again. Our relationship's not over, Peter. It's one of those words of kindness and hope, I think, which reminds us, in those circumstances where you feel like you've blown it so badly, where you feel like it's enough to sever that relationship and Jesus wouldn't want another bar of you, and lots of other people wouldn't have another bar of you, Jesus does. Jesus' death is so sufficient. He's dealt with all sin, and his forgiveness is so great, and his love for you so strong that there will always be room for forgiveness to draw you back into relationship with him. Now, as we look at Peter, it's very clear that he is not the powerful one in this passage. He's the powerless. He's scared. Things are outside his control. Each time he's confronted, he caves in immediately. He stands in contrast to Jesus, which I think is why it goes, Peter, Jesus, Peter, Jesus, because it just highlights Jesus, the man of control, of courage, of righteousness, of innocence. Whereas when Peter, the pressure comes on, he caves in. Jesus doesn't. And so where does power lie in the account? Well, not Peter, but it does seem to with the authorities. See, there's the Jewish authorities who seem to have a great deal of power here. There's the Roman authorities who seem to have at least as much or even more power here. The Jewish authorities seem to hold all the cards. The high priest, chief priest, teacher of the law. They're the leaders of the people. They're the highest echelons of society. Some of them form together the Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling council that makes decisions and functions as a court. And they held great moral, political, and social authority. Now, they're the ones who seem to be in control. They've arrested Jesus. They've got their temple guard. The temple guard's gone out and done their bidding and brought him in. They've brought him to trial. They question him. They demand answers from him. And in the end, they're the ones who are going to decide his fate. And they do. So verse 65, after they've condemned him, they spit on him, they blindfold him, they mock him, they punch him in the head. They call him to prophesy while they're punching him, which is an act of mockery. You know, you're a prophet. Who's hitting you? Who's punched you that time? It's mocking him as a prophet. And yet the irony of the moment is, even as they do it, it's fulfilling prophecy that Jesus has uttered previously, that he would be beaten and mistreated and suffer and mocked and die and after that to rise. And they let their guards beat him too. So it seems like the Jewish leaders are the ones in utter control, the total power players. They have all the cards except for one card. And the card that they don't hold is execution. Because the Jews are a subjugated people, the Romans exist as the authority over them. And so if you wanted to execute someone publicly, you needed the Romans to give permission. And so that's why the Jewish religious leaders then take Jesus to Pontius Pilate, the Roman procurator or governor of that region during that time, because they wanted permission to publicly execute a public figure once and for all. And again, now it looks like the Roman authorities are in control. He's the one who questions Jesus. He's the one who hears the accusations against Jesus. He's the one who decides Jesus' fate. He's the one who eventually hands Jesus over to execution. But even here, there's an interesting little twist. It's the power of the crowd. You see in verse 10, Pilate wants to let Jesus go. He knows that it's out of self-interest that the chief priests have handed Jesus over to him. He knows Jesus is innocent. So Jesus is innocent. It's just out of self-interest that Jesus has been handed over by the Jewish religious leaders. He wants to let Jesus go. And so he tries to have Jesus released. But the chief priests stir up the crowd. And instead, Pilate is forced into a position where he releases Barabbas instead of releasing Jesus. He releases a murderer and insurrectionist rather than Jesus. Which reminds us that even those who seem to have the greatest power can be influenced by the masses, can be influenced by the mob. And you can get a small group, a minority group, influencing the masses, which influences the people in power, which changes the outcome of everything. Now, don't you see that everywhere today? Small groups making lots of noise in the media, in the social media, influencing the general public, putting pressure on political forces, shaping things in all manner of ways, many of which are unhelpful. So there's all sorts of power dynamics going on here, but it looks like the Jewish leaders and the Roman leaders seem to be the ones with the major power. That is until you compare them with Jesus, which I think is what's going on. Jesus compared with Peter, but Jesus compared with the rulers here. I think Mark is intentionally drawing the contrast. Because when you look at Jesus, what do you see? Utter calm control. He says a few things, but most of the time he's silent before his accusers. He is utterly in control of his situation, utterly calm. But you also see his power in the titles that are used of him and the titles he uses of himself. Have a look there in verse 61 of chapter 14. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" And those two titles are synonymous, which is why there's a comma there. The Messiah is the same as saying the Son of the Blessed One or the Son of God. Son of God means Messiah. I think what often happens is we're used to Jesus being the Son of God. And so when we hear people in the New Testament use the title Son of God, we immediately think, oh, Jesus, divine, God the Son. But usually when the title Son of God is used, it really means Messiah. So in the Old Testament, when someone was a son of God, they had a special relationship with God. They were esteemed by God. So Israel was the son of God. And the kings of the Old Testament were the sons of God. And Psalm 2, which was read for us before, said when the great Messiah comes, he will be the son of God. And so son of God, on the lips of the high priest and many people's lips in the New Testament, means Messiah, which is why he uses these two things interchangeably. Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? Same thing. Are you the Christ? Are you the long-awaited King who has promised would one day come and rule over all things forever and bring about judgment and salvation? Now, the reason that the high priest asked that question is because the Messiah is the king. And so when a Roman ruler like Pilate hears king, Messiah, they hear king of the Jews. And there's only one king in the Roman Empire, and that's Caesar. And so if someone else claims to be king, that's treason, and they're to be arrested and executed. That's what the high priest wants Jesus to admit, that he's the Messiah, that he's the king of the Jews, so they can hand him over for execution. Now, a little interesting thing is, as you move through the New Testament, that Son of God title, well, Jesus starts to fill it out as he talks about his unique and special relationship with his Father. So he's the Messiah, but he's the Messiah who truly is actually God the Son. He's the Messiah who has an intimate, special relationship with his Father who has been sent from his Father. You see it in Mark 12. Remember the parable of the vineyard, the tenants in the vineyard? And he talks about how the owner sent his son. And the owner's son is going to receive the inheritance, hinting that that's him. This Messiah is the son of the owner who's going to rule over all things. Now, how does Jesus respond to the question? Verse 62, "I am," said Jesus. "I am the Messiah." Now, right through the gospel, haven't you noticed that Jesus keeps hosing that down? Every time someone starts to talk about king and Messiah type stuff, he says, "Don't tell anyone. Don't tell anyone." And yet now is the moment where he is handing himself over fully to his Father's will, where it's the moment for him to die to bring salvation. And so he says very clearly, "I am." Perhaps also hinting at his divinity, using a name of God from back in Exodus 3. But Jesus is saying, "I'm the Messiah. I'm the king who has come in all power. I've been established by God to rule over all things, and I bring judgment and salvation." It might look like the high priest and his gang are in control. It might look like Pilate is in control. But the reality of this situation is God's appointed king is standing here. The ruler of the universe is standing here. You heard it in Psalm 2. God says, "I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain." God has appointed Jesus as the king. In Psalm 2, "You are my son. Today I've become your father." The Messiah is the Son of God. In Psalm 2, "I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You'll break them with a rod of iron. You'll dash them to pieces like pottery." The Messiah's rule will be uncontested, absolute, and all enemies will be crushed under his feet. And that's this one, Jesus. The one they're smacking in the face. The one they're mocking. The one they're spitting on. This is the ruler of the universe. Now, can you imagine the moment when these guys die? A moment of terrible regret. Where you stand before Jesus as the king of the universe, the judge of all things, and this is how you've treated him. But you notice Jesus says more than that. He says, I am, verse 62. But then he goes on and says, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. You're going to see me sitting at the right hand of God Almighty, the position of power. I'll be his right hand man, the one who carries out his will. And he picks up imagery from Daniel 7, the Son of Man language, which we've been seeing as we've moved right throughout Mark's gospel. That prophecy about one like a son of man, one like a human being, who one day is going to come into the presence of the Lord God Almighty and receive all power and glory and might and rule forever. And Jesus says, that's me. I'm the one who's going to rule over everything, all things eternally with all power and with all might. Now, doesn't that sound similar to Messiah? And the reason is because two separate titles, two separate promises in the Old Testament actually come to fulfillment in one man. Both about utter rule, total kingship, defeat of enemies come together in the one man, Jesus. Absolute power in its scope and its length, total power forever. Jesus is that one. And so you look at this passage and it looks like the Romans are in authority. It looks like the Jews are in authority. They think they've got the power. They think they're the ones calling the shots. They think they're the ones standing in judgment. They think they're the ones that have Jesus in their hand, his fate in their hands. And yet the reality is, Jesus is the one who will stand judgment upon them. Their fate is ultimately in the hands of Jesus. Jesus is the one with absolute total power. Jesus is totally underestimated. Which focuses us in then on how power is being exercised in the account. So who's got the power, but then how's it being used? How are the authorities using it? How's Jesus using it? Well, firstly, you look at how the authorities use it and it's in corruption, injustice, weakness, evil, terrible decisions. You look at the Jewish authorities. They come at night and arrest Jesus, and Jesus makes a point of saying, look, I was in the temple courts every day, and yet you come here at night with swords and clubs and arrest me. They pull him before the Sanhedrin, a court convened at night, illegally convened for obvious reasons, drawing together a court at night, hastily drawn together for putting Jesus to death. It's a kangaroo court, utterly unconcerned with justice. Rather, you can see what drives them in 1455. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so they could put him to death, but they did not find any. So it doesn't say the Sanhedrin were wanting to hear the evidence for and against and make a wise judgment about whether Jesus was guilty or innocent. The whole purpose of the court is so that they might put him to death. And then they bring forward witness after witness, actually false witness after false witness, people who they've lined up to bring lies against Jesus, but their stories don't match up. Eventually someone comes in and gives the false statement, verse 58. We heard him say, I'll destroy this temple made with human hands. In 3 days we'll build another, not made with hands. Yet even then their testimony did not agree. So they say something Jesus didn't say. You look at John 2 and Jesus said, destroy this temple and I'll raise it in 3 days. But if you destroy this temple, which they do, Jesus' body, he's referring to himself, I'll raise it in 3 days. But they claim Jesus said, I will destroy this temple, which he never said. And their testimonies don't agree. You get this sense that the Sanhedrin are desperate. They're throwing anything that they can against him to try to bring him down and condemn him. False witness, false testimony, lies. And yet you also get this sense that Jesus is so innocent, so pure that it just seems to roll off. It just seems to crumble around him and collapse. Nothing can stick. And all through it, Jesus stands there silent. So the high priest goes for the jugular. Are you the Messiah? Are you the Son of God? And as you've seen, Jesus says he is. And that's what they need because he's claiming to be a king so they can hand him over to be executed. So they condemn him with blasphemy, spit on him, mock him, punch him, hand him to Pilate to be executed. And later, they stir up the crowds so that an insurrectionist and a murderer is released and Jesus, the innocent one, is crucified. How's power exercised by the Jewish authorities? Utter corruption, utter injustice, utter evil, driven by self-preservation of their own power. What about the Roman authorities? The Romans are no friends of the Jews. Pilate didn't like the Jews. In fact, a number of times he'd treated them very brutally, shedding blood, putting down little rebellions with massacres. But there's an emperor who's coming into power, Tiberius. He's sympathetic to the Jews. He wants more moderation. And he's very wary of any of his procurators or governors doing anything that he doesn't approve of. Pilate is being more cautious, and so he allows the Jews a hearing. He talks to Jesus and he asks Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Because that's the charge that's been brought. "Are you the king of the Jews?" Which Jesus responds, you see there, "You have said so." Which is probably saying like, "Those are your words," which is a bit ambiguous, neither a denial nor an affirmation. You see there in verse 4 that more charges are brought against Jesus by the religious leaders. And Pilate asks Jesus, "Are you going to respond?" But again, Jesus is silent, doesn't respond. And Pilate's amazed. So Pilate thinks, I've got to get out of this situation. Jesus is innocent. It's just out of self-interest they're doing this. And so he tries to pull the card of, at this time, at Passover time, the Romans had the tradition of releasing one Jewish prisoner over to them. And so he says to them, "Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" He thinks, "I'm going to be able to give Jesus over and let him go free." But the chief priests stir up the crowd and Barabbas is freed and Jesus is released released instead of Jesus. You see there, verse 12. "What shall I do then with the one you call the king of the Jews?" Pilate asked them. "Crucify him," they shouted. "Why, what crime has he committed?" asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, "Crucify him." Wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas to them. He had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. Pilate knows Jesus is innocent, wants to release him, but he's driven by the crowd to yield to them, and so injustice is done, and he shows weakness. You see, they've each got power, and yet their power is exercised in corruption, in weakness, in injustice, in evil, which reminds us, don't be surprised when you look at people in power and you see them doing evil things. For Christmas, got this portable speaker thing, a Bluetooth speaker. So on your phone, you can play music and it's loud-ish, you know. But then you hook it up to this little baby and it's booming. Yeah, it's really loud. It massively amplifies it. That little portable speaker, I reckon, is a bit like power to sin. So you imagine your phone's pumping out music. Our lives are pumping out sin in various forms, self-interest, greed, lust, all manner of things, idolatry. And yet, once you get power into the equation, it's like an amplifier. It tends to take the things that we're already doing, the sins we're already committing, and often amplifies them. No, not in every case. But we do those same things, and we do them more rigorously, and we do other things that we wouldn't have thought of doing. And as you get into doing those things, it leads to a downward spiral. And the reason is, we don't sin more because we don't have the opportunity. If we had more opportunity, we would sin more. And when you get power, you suddenly have more opportunity. Often it comes in the form of money, liquid power. When you have more opportunity, you have more opportunity to sin. That doesn't mean everyone does all the time. But what it often does is it amplifies and magnifies the sin that's already going on because we have more opportunity and so express our sin more rigorously. The other element to power is that once you have power, you don't want to lose it. Very, very hard to let go of power and position. And so you then start to do anything that will keep that power. What would I do to make sure I don't lose this? What wouldn't I do to make sure I don't lose this? And suddenly you start doing unthinkable things that you never thought you would do in order to maintain the power that you have. And then we've seen that all over our world with terrible atrocities committed, even in current world history. Now, it's not always the case, but power tends to corrupt, and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. Don't be surprised also at the stupidity of people in authority, at the crazy decisions that people make. This is the worst decision you could possibly make, isn't it? God has come amongst us. Let's kill him. Now, the Jews and the Romans are making the biggest and worst decision ever. So we hear people in power thinking, you think, what? The media has what take on things? You hear politicians make a decision. Don't you think things like, am I living in the same world? Can't you see the long-term consequences of that decision? Can't you see the impact, the implications of that way of thinking? No, I can't. Because the very nature of sin is to cloud our thinking, especially in the spiritual and moral realms, to cloud our thinking. And so as humans, we make dumb decisions. But you add power to that, and the decisions are prone to be worse. Because as we've said before, power causes you to want to keep your power. You don't want to lose it. And so when you're making decisions, the impulse is always towards protect my power. Make the decision that's going to keep me in this situation. That's going to keep the public happy so I don't get voted out. That's going to keep me in my job. That's going to... And so power nudges in a certain direction. And the certain direction is self-interest. Keep the status quo. Keep me in power. Keep pushing me towards greater power. And so your decisions can easily get pushed in those directions, shifted, corrupted. Now, that's not to say all people with power make stupid and terrible decisions. Not at all. But don't be surprised. Don't be surprised when people in power make stupid, terrible decisions, particularly in the moral and spiritual spheres. So there you go. You see the exercise of power of the authorities. But what about Jesus? How does he exercise his power? We've seen that he has ultimate and total power here. How does he use it? Well, as you move through the passage, I reckon a couple of things really stand out. The things that stood out to me were his innocence. Yeah, nothing sticks. They throw false testimony at him. None of it sticks. You get to the end of the passage and Pilate says, what crime has he committed? Hey, this is the innocent one. He hasn't done anything wrong. The perfect, righteous and sinless one stands there. He's innocent. But the other thing that stands out as you move through the passage is his silence. He doesn't defend himself. He doesn't speak up as he's accused. He says a couple, one or two things that he really wants to get out. But apart from that, he's silent. Innocence, silence. And I reckon the reason that those two things stand out in the passage is because Jesus is the suffering servant of Isaiah 53. Jesus is consciously fulfilling Isaiah 53. Now come with me there. Because I reckon what you see in Isaiah 53 when you've been in Mark 14 and 15 is, wow, this is Mark 14 and 15. Isaiah 53, have a look at verse 7. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He's led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. Under this affliction and oppression, he's silent. He doesn't open his mouth. Like a lamb being taken off to sacrifice to the slaughter, he's silent, doesn't open his mouth. Verse 8, by oppression and judgment he was taken away. Yet who of this his generation protested? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was punished. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. Perfectly innocent. No violence. No deceit. It was oppression and judgment by which he was taken away. Injustice. Who of his generation protested? No one. Everyone let him go. Everyone was silent. He was cut off from the land of the living. Why? For the transgression of my people. Not for his own transgression and law breaking, but for theirs. Which you see more of it in verse 4. What's he doing here? Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering. Yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him. And by his wounds we are healed. We all like sheep have gone astray. And each of us has turned to our own way. And the Lord laid on him the iniquity of us all. Why is Jesus the innocent, the silent one? What's he doing? How is he exercising his power? In sacrificial service. He's the suffering servant, the one who is absolutely and utterly innocent, who is giving himself over to die in order to save us. He was punished so we can have peace with God. He was crushed for our iniquities. He was pierced for our transgressions. The punishment that was on him brings us peace. Willingly, silently, innocently, he takes our place, taking the punishment we deserve for our sin. How did Jesus use his power? He served. He served to death. And when you come back to Mark's gospel, what you notice is a little picture of that, of how that works. A little illustration, which is the Barabbas event. So it really happened, but the Barabbas event also works as a little illustration. The guilty man, the murder insurrectionist, the guilty man goes free, Barabbas, but only because the innocent man dies, Jesus. That's us. We go free, but only because Jesus dies in our place. When power is truly and rightly exercised, it's in service. Use of any power is to be given in service. That's what God has been doing for all eternity. God is the God of love and service, of overflowing goodness, of overflowing holiness and purity. And our life should be a life of service as well. Now, this is actually a part of profound reality shift. The problem is we've heard this all the time, but the reality is all of my life is about service, serving God, serving others. Any position I have, any privileges, any position, power, abilities, anything is to be harnessed towards the end of service. We're to serve like the servant king, the king who served us. The King of Kings, the Messiah, the Son of Man, who is here giving himself over willingly to death so that we could be brought back to God. Philippians 2 tells us that's exactly how we live, model our lives off Jesus. Which means if you're a leader in any sphere of your life, you're a servant. True power is to be exercised in love and service. To exercise leadership for our own ends, for our own prestige, for our own honour, so that we get recognised, so that we get praised, so that we get ahead, so that we move up the ladder, is totally out of step with what it means to be a human, let alone a follower of Jesus. In your workplace, if you have authority over people, you've been given that authority so that you might serve the people who work under you in your workplace, and so that you might help them to serve the people that your workplace is set up to serve. In your ministry, if you have authority over people, it is to be exercised in love and service. You're to love and serve your ministry team and to help your ministry team to serve the people that it was set up to serve, which will cost you time and effort and energy and comfort and a whole bunch of things. We possess power in a bunch of different forms, forms that we might not always think about. Some of us possess power in relational abilities. You're really good with people, confident, outgoing. You have an ability to draw a crowd, to make things work. That's power. That's a great power. And that power can be used for great ill or great good. It can be used for great ill, belittling people, making people feel small and unimportant, using your relational position to make them feel excluded, using humour to cut, dominating them so it pushes you to the top of the social hierarchy. Or we can use that power for incredible good, helping people feel loved, welcomed, connecting people to one another, setting up conversations in such a way where it helps those who find conversation more difficult to be drawn out, drawn into the conversation to make it more easy for people. To have conversations that lift and build and grow people. We can possess the power of intellect. Smart, fast, sharp, retain information, solve problems quickly. Power. Now that power can be used for great ill. We can wield it like a weapon to make people feel stupid and dumb and small and insignificant. We can speak in such a way that invalidates people's ideas and makes them afraid to ever speak up again. We can use our intellect merely for ourselves to get ahead, to get the good marks, to get the good jobs, to get the more pay, to get the better house, to get the, so that we're pushed up and forward by use of our intellect. Or we can use the great gift, the great powerful gift of an intellect to serve the Lord, to serve his people as a powerful tool. We can possess the power of experience. We know how to do things because we've done those things before. And as often as you get older, you've got much more wealth of experience, and you can use that power of experience, wielding it like a club to put people in their place and keep them down so that you are seen as the one who should be esteemed. Or you can humbly share your experiences, recognizing that people won't take on everything you say, in such a way that enriches others and helps people 2 decades younger than you to stand on your shoulders and move forward. We can possess physical power, strength, size, speed, ability, and we can use it to bully, brutalize, beat, abuse. Or we can use it for hard work, for protection of the weak and vulnerable, and in gentleness and kindness. As parents, we have great power, and we can use that for real harm to our kids or incredible good in their lives. But what's the power that you possess? And how will you exercise it? Because the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. The Son of Man came to not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. When I first became a Christian 27 years ago, there was a song that we used to sing in church, and we'd sing a fair bit, but the power of music is it's etched in my brain. Let me just give you the first verse and chorus. It says, from heaven you came, helpless babe, entered our world, your glory veiled, not to be served, but to serve, and give your life that we might live. This is our God, the servant king, who calls us now to follow him, to bring our lives as a daily offering of worship to the servant king. Now, Trev's going to jump up now. He's actually going to play that song just as an item so we can continue to reflect on the wonderful service that Jesus has offered us and continue to think about how will we follow in his footsteps and use the power and abilities and gifts that we have been given in service of others.